Once again, we're considering the topic that has been before us for quite some time now, and that is those things which are most surely believed among us. As a denomination, there are things that we hold dear with other believers. There are some other things that we would say that we hold dear. We certainly believe in those things. They're not necessarily of the essence of faith. They're not of the essence of salvation. You can believe or not believe those things and still be a Christian. But certainly, as far as the mission and work of our own denomination is concerned, we feel there are certain matters that are important for Christian testimony. And among those, we've been looking recently at points of practical emphasis, that as a church we believe there are certain standards that we should have, things that we should want from our members, because we are a community of believers with a collective as well as a personal testimony. And one of the areas that we've been dealing with and will be over the next few weeks is that of the abstinence position that we take with regard to the beverage use of alcohol. Now, many people, many Christians who agree with us on many other things disagree with us in regard to our standard of abstinence from the non-medicinal use of alcohol. Such folks will argue that wine was used by God's people throughout biblical history, and therefore it is wrong to actually impose a standard of abstinence on our church members. And I'm quoting here from Separated Under the Gospel. That is a book, it's a little compendium of doctrine and of practical positions that our church takes. So I'm quoting directly from the book. And it says the word impose is the wrong word. We are a fellowship of people who voluntarily abstain from alcoholic drink. Now, no Christian is compelled to join the Free Presbyterian Church. The idea that someone's conscience is going to be bound and that that would mean that we would force them to become members is incorrect. No one is forced to become a member of the church. But those who do wish to be communicant members in our congregations with the right to vote, and in the case of males, be voted into office as overseers or office bearers, they obviously must agree to the position of voluntary abstinence. Now, Separated Under the Gospel actually gives several reasons for the abstinence position. We abstain for testimony's sake, leaving aside the exegetical controversy as to whether the Bible actually does in fact sanction the use of alcoholic drink. There's very good reason for our temperance stand. And incidentally, this is not something, as is often alleged, that has its origins among those of an Arminian persuasion. I've heard that quite often from some Reformed brothers, and in point of fact, they are incorrect. I know that many of God's men in history who believe, as we do, in the doctrines of grace, were equally strong in their stand for total abstinence. In fact, I have a book at home which is called Irish Worthies. It is a compendium of sermons of men of God who ministered in the Irish Presbyterian Church in the 19th century. And among those were several ministers who were very, very much to the fore, very much in the vanguard of the temperance, the various temperance movements that were in existence at the time. We believe that this is a case where abstinence is a step which is taken to protect our testimony and also to enlarge our usefulness in gospel witness. The country is sinking in an ocean of alcohol. That was written quite some years ago, and if it was true then, it's true today. It is actually, and many will confirm this who are not even Christians, the major form of drug addiction in the nation. Alcohol is killing its millions. And in order to bear an effective witness to this drink-sodden generation, if we were at the same time to indulge, it would be akin to preaching to a drug addict while we're using marijuana, in moderation, of course. Because after all, it's nowhere specifically prohibited in Scripture. We abstain for testimony's sake. We abstain out of love for the brethren. I know there are those that will scoff at this and will mock at this, but the fact of the matter is that many people, and some I know personally, in our churches have been saved from lives of alcoholism. And we do take the words of the Apostle Paul in Romans 14, verse 21, seriously. He said there, "It is good neither to eat flesh, nor to drink wine, nor anything whereby thy brother stumbleth, or is offended, or is made weak." And as a church, we believe that Christians' indulgence in alcohol is very definitely, could be very definitely, a source of stumbling and offense to those whom the Lord has saved out of utter bondage to drink, as well as to the many who are still enslaved by it. I mentioned a brother last time who I know very well, have known him for many years, who was converted. He had been a very severe drunkard, what the world likes to call an alcoholic. He was a drunkard. He couldn't do without drink. The night he was converted, he was lying in his own vomit prior to being saved. And he told me personally that when he has attended certain Reformed churches in particular, if they were going to permit him to remain for communion, he has had to ask the question if they use alcohol for the cup. Because if they do, he would have to abstain. Because of the problem that he has in his own body. Now, people could say, well, isn't he trusting the Lord? Isn't he looking to the Lord to keep him and to help him? I believe that to be a very foolish approach to take to that. The fact of the matter is that that man recognizes that if he were to touch it again, then it's highly likely, whatever his Christian profession, that he would, to use a worldly term, fall off the wagon and possibly be back where he was before. That has nothing to do with trusting the Lord or not trusting the Lord. It happens to be a fact that drink, in his case, would be a huge stumbling block, and it is actually an offense to him. There are things, and the Separated Under the Gospel book makes it clear, things that we may personally and narrowly consider lawful to us, but that are not expedient and are not for the edification of others. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is a reference that's given, verse 23. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. And we know that Paul lays down a similar rule for God's people in verse 24, "Let no man seek his own, but every man another's wealth." And the word wealth there is not talking about money, it means his welfare. So we should be thinking about the welfare of others. And by the way, that's a command. That's a command. It is an ordained rule or standard, and we believe that it makes it incumbent on us, faced with the incalculable devastation caused by alcohol, to separate ourselves totally from it unto the Lord. And it is unto the Lord that we do it. It is not, as is often alleged, some kind of bitter legalism. It's an expression of our love for the Lord, for his testimony, and for the welfare of others, including other believers. And in the Bible, God actually commended, in one instance at least, abstainers. It has become popular for many, from secular writers to Roman Catholic writers to some Calvinists even, to belittle and to condemn those who take the position that our church takes. And I would repeat what it says in Separated Under the Gospel, that does not concern us in the slightest. It doesn't concern me in the slightest what may be written against us. When Jonadab, the son of Rechab, Jeremiah chapter 35, entered into a covenant to abstain from drinking wine, and he commanded it to his sons, he wasn't condemned by God, he was actually commended. His sons were not mocked as a bunch of embondaged legalists, but they were held forth actually as a good example by the Lord. Jeremiah 35 from verse 5 through to verse 14. We believe that abstinence is the correct position, and for the reasons we have cited, it still has God's commendation. And finally, in this regard, let me say that by abstaining, we express our liberty, our purity, our testimony, and our community. And some people today in the world at large think that you can't enjoy yourself without introducing alcohol to the equation. You can't have a party, you can't have a get-together, you can't have any sort of social occasion without drink. Otherwise, it's not going to be enjoyable. Well, I disagree with that. Our church disagrees with that. We have fellowship times all the time, and we have a good time, I think, and there's never any drink to be seen or smelt even in the area. We're not afraid to see the world in which we live as God's world. It's to be used and not abused. We rejoice in the truth of what's called common grace, and we can therefore happily receive all the relative good that has come to us through unsaved men even as the provision of our loving God. And the standards that we have as a church, these personal standards for members, are not, in our view at least, standards of bondage. Others will disagree. They are actually expressions of our liberty, of our purity, our testimony, and our community, because they tell the weakest believer among us that we care enough for him and indeed for his children to banish even the possibility of our causing him to stumble. Now, last time we met, I gave you some reasons why I believe that abstinence is the correct position for us to take as a church. We abstain for these reasons, first of all, for social reasons. And we've hinted at that this morning. Today I want to look at the second reason, and that is that we are abstainers for sensible reasons. Now, of course, some will tell us the total abstinence position is not scriptural, and I will come to that in due course. And furthermore, they will say that it is actually an improper binding of the conscience of others, even other believers. People should be able to make up their own minds on these things, we are told. After all, in Bible days, people drank. And although drunkenness, the abuse of drink, is condemned, moderation in drinking alcohol is not condemned. Now, there is some controversy on that particular matter. There are those who take the position that because there are different usages of the word wine, both in the Old Testament and in the New, the Hebrew yayin, or the word in the Greek oinos, that where it's used in a good connotation, it's non-alcoholic. Where it is used in an evil or bad connotation, it is alcoholic. Now, personally, I feel that that position is very hard to, it's very, very hard to endorse and to support. But it is a genuinely held view by some. And I think they have a right to hold that view furthermore. But if we take this particular point, the idea that a person can be a moderate imbiber of alcoholic drinks without sinning, the question is that correct? Is that true? And let me say, it's not just a matter of finding some text in the Bible about drinking wine and saying, if it was okay then, it's okay now. Some people think it is that simple, but it is not, frankly, that simple. There are a number of issues that have to be looked at in a sensible and reasonable fashion. And that's why I'm saying this particular point is, for sensible reasons, we abstain. One of the things that we have to consider before we go any further is the difference in the drinks in biblical times and the times in which we live. Now, it is a fact, it is a plain fact, that the Bible never mentions products such as whiskey, rum, brandy, cognac, vodka, gin, and a number of other potent drinks. The Bible never mentions those. You know why? Because they weren't invented. They did not exist in Bible times. So when Mr. Reformed Imbiber tells me that he's drinking a glass of whiskey and it's because Paul told Timothy, use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine often infirmities, I will tell Mr. Reformed Imbiber, that's not scriptural. The position that you've just outlined has no basis in scripture at all. Because, and I'm speaking here not from scripture, but from everyday life, it is a fact that in Bible times, the process that we call distillation and even other artificial fermentation processes that are available today were not invented until centuries after the scriptures were written down. I used to minister in Scotland, and Scotland is very well known for its distilleries, for its whiskey distilleries, especially in the northern parts where the water is very good, and you have products like Drambuie and any number of other whiskies. And people can visit those distilleries and they can have a little shot and taste the whiskey for themselves. It's big business. They export the whiskey all over the world. But the processes that are used, the distillation processes that are used, were not invented when the scriptures were written. And so it needs to be considered and it needs to be emphasized. These very strong drinks did not even exist either in the Old Testament or the New Testament. I mentioned the book by Peter Masters, who is a Reformed minister, by the way, in London, England, Should Christians Drink? The Case for Total Abstinence. And in that book, he says this, quote, regardless of whether abstention was required in New Testament times, it became the biblical duty of all Christians with the passing of time, as the size and character of the alcohol industry underwent dramatic changes in terms of the quantity, potency, and human costliness of its products. Unquote. Now, it seems clear that at one time, wine may have been permitted for believers, although we should be very careful about assuming that all wines are involved in that, or that all references to wine mean alcoholic or fermented wine. Because frankly, this is not the case. You may be surprised by that, others may be surprised by that, but every place that the Bible mentions wine, it is not synonymous with alcohol. The biblical words for wine were used generically, and they referred to both alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks. A similar use of such generic wording in the English language is liquor or liqueur, cider, punch, and drink. And people will sometimes say to me, do you drink? I said, yes, every day. Tea, coffee, water, milk, soft drinks. Yes, I drink every day. So you imbibe drink? No, I don't. I don't drink alcohol, if that's what you mean. This is a usage of everyday language, the word drink. It depends what you mean by it, right? Do you drink? Well, what do you mean, do I drink? Well, then you will flesh that out. Do I drink alcohol or do I drink other drinks? Similar usages of the word cider are relevant here. where I come from, cider is something that you would not want to drink because it's very strong. It's alcohol. Whereas here, and I understood this one day when someone offered me some cider and I nearly fell off the chair, I understood that it's actually apple cider. And so there's no alcohol in it. It depends what you mean by cider, therefore, when you use that. Punch would be the same. Punch could either be your clenched fist across the side of your head, or punch could be a drink that is made, and punch can be alcoholic or it can be non-alcoholic. The word wine is exactly the same. And the Bible, for example, in Proverbs chapter 3, verse 10, calls wine that which is grape juice. Now, these are matters that are not to be denied. Whatever one may think of this subject, you would have to admit, when you look at the Scriptures, that there are places where the word wine is employed and it does not refer to alcoholic wine. So this idea, oh, it says wine, that means it's wine. It doesn't. It doesn't mean alcoholic wine everywhere it's mentioned. Isaiah chapter 16, verse 10, it says, and gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field, and in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. If you know anything about how this is done, grapes are all put into a big vat type thing, and they would actually tread on those grapes with their feet. And what would come out? Well, what would come out is grape juice, but the Bible calls it wine. It's not fermented, but the Bible calls it wine. And there are other scriptures I could mention. In Joel chapter 2, verse 24, you have another reference which speaks of the same thing. It's non-alcoholic. In Mark chapter 15, verse 36, in the New Testament, the reference is to vinegar. And there's even a place where, in Isaiah chapter 65, verse 8, to be exact, it actually refers to grapes on the vine, grapes that are still attached. Isaiah 65, verse 8, thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster. See that? So it's called wine, even though it's still in the fruit. So how could it be alcoholic? And of course, it does sometimes refer to an alcoholic wine. And the Lord Jesus referred to both kinds of wine in Matthew chapter 9 and verse 17. Let me find that reference for you. Matthew 9, 17. Neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break, and the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. They're both called oinos, or wine. There was a Greek translation made of the Hebrew Bible around 200 BC. It is known as the Septuagint, or the Septuagint. Some people have different pronunciations. And it also uses words for wine interchangeably. And this also addresses the reason why wine is condemned in some places in the Bible and lauded in other places. That I would agree with. Now, over and again, non-alcoholic wine was called by the name wine. And it was common throughout the years. So, contrary to the assertion that unfermented wine could not have been readily available before the days of refrigeration or pasteurization, the truth is that the ancients practiced half a dozen or more ways to preserve grape juice and other kinds of fruit juices as either alcoholic or non-alcoholic. These are facts. The ancients, they were far more resourceful than people nowadays give them credit for. Now, the determination of whether the Bible is speaking about fermented wine or unfermented wine may often be the context. But it's important for us to consider these matters. All references to wine are not references to fermented or alcoholic wine. It's interesting to note the two that Joseph dealt with in the prison. You remember that story? The butler and the baker. The butler was shown to be one who squeezed grapes into the cup of Pharaoh. Are you going to tell me that by the time Pharaoh drank that, it was alcoholic? I think not. And yet, in those days, that was referred to as the drinking of wine. Now, I've heard it said a multitude of times, "Oh, but Jesus made wine at the wedding at Cana." As if the Bible clearly teaches that the Lord actually made a product that would cause people, if they drank enough of it, to be drunk. And by the way, those feasts would last for 3 days minimum. This was near the end of the feast when the Lord made the wine. He turned the water into wine. Are you seriously going to tell me that people had been imbibing alcoholic wine for about 3 days and Jesus made more of it to make them more drunk? I mean, are people seriously going to affirm that? Because that's what they're really saying when they tell us that Jesus turned water into alcoholic wine. Personally, I do not believe Christ made alcoholic wine at Cana. I don't. Nor do I accept that the fruit of the vine, as it's called at the Last Supper, was anything more than the fruit of the vine, grape juice. Or perhaps a cordial produced by the boiling away of the alcoholic content, as was very common in that day. But for the sake of argument, let's concede that something like drinking of alcoholic wine was lawful at one time. Does that follow that it's still lawful and that it always will be lawful, or that it's even expedient for us today? I believe it was Masters who gave this illustration, and I thought it was a good one. In the Bible, it teaches a form of modified slavery. You go to Exodus chapter 21, you can study it for yourself. You'll find there that the Lord actually gave laws with regard to servitude, but it's actually slavery. And people were allowed to have slaves and their families for 6 years, and in the seventh year they would let the slave go free. There was also a provision for a slave to stay with his master if he wanted to, and if he did that, he would be taken to the post of the door, and an instrument called an awl would be used to bore a hole in his ear in sign that he was going to be a perpetual slave. And that's where we get that hymn from, I love my master, I will not go out free, for he is my redeemer, he gave his life for me. We are the Lord's slaves. Now that modified slavery has often been used by people to teach that slavery is still justified in the world today. If it was permitted to Israel as an expedient, then it should be permitted for us today. I disagree with that. Of course, it was the case that if folks became bankrupt, they weren't able to support their families, a reasonable and benevolent system of slavery would provide for their material welfare. As I say, some have argued from that and from Paul's apparent lack of condemnation of slavery in the New Testament. He never really said a whole lot about it that was negative, that therefore it's okay for us to practice it. And after all, great preachers such as George Whitefield had slaves, so therefore it would be okay for us today. Now, is that true? Well, I would say it's not true, because mankind so exploited human slavery that it became a running sore in the world. And few Christians, I would say, today would argue for slavery, even in moderation. Things have moved on. I think we could also speak about dancing. It's a subject all of its own, but dancing in the Old Testament, such as David did before the ark, It was part of ancient Hebrew culture. It wasn't evil in and of itself. It was totally unlike the modern dance with its sensual and sexual overtones. There are some who will argue, of course, for dancing in so-called worship today. But I suggest that most people who are seeking to follow after God will know that that's not something that's to be done in the day in which we live. Things have been invented by sinful men since biblical days that are evil. And no clear biblical injunction is written regarding it. For example, and I used this last time, mind-altering drugs. It's a fact that even the fermented wine of Bible days was not anything like as potent as, say, table wine in our own day. And we'll come back to this next time, but it is an important point for us to note the usages of the word wine in the Bible, the different contexts in which it is used. The Bible talks, for example, about much wine. It talks about tarrying long at the wine. I'm going to tell you there are wines and there are products on the market today. You wouldn't have to tarry long, and you wouldn't have to have much of it to be drunk. In actual fact, if you look at the Pennsylvania driver's manual, and I did when I had to take my test over here, it says in there that the only safe level of alcohol in your blood if you're going to drive is zero. Zero. Now, that's what the world says. That's what the authorities say. It only takes a very small amount of modern day product in your veins to make you to be impaired, driving under the influence. And no doubt people in the Bible got drunk, but in general, alcoholic beverages were considerably weaker than many strong wines today, particularly the chaptalized and fortified wines and, of course, distilled spirits. But we're going to come back to this point next time in the will of the Lord. Further sensible reasons why we should abstain from the beverage use of alcohol. I believe this to be an important subject, especially in the day in which we live, not just for the young people, but for older people as well. We want to have a testimony that's pure. We want to have a testimony that is glorifying to God. And may the Lord help us so to do in this and every other area of our lives.